Chapter 22. Quiet time to talk things over, and now I've got it, I mean to make you hear me out. His first rush of inarticulate resentment had been followed by a steadiness and concentration of tone more disconcerting to Lily than the excitement preceding it. For a moment her presence of mind forsook her. As he had more than once been in situations where a quick sword play of wit had been needful to cover her retreat. But her frightened heartthrobs told her that here such skill would not avail. "The guy in time," she repeated, "colon, I don't understand what you want." Trina had pushed a chair between herself and the door. He threw himself in it and leaned back, looking up at her. "I'll tell you what I want. I want to know just where you and I stand. Hang it, the man who pays for the dinner is generally allowed to have a seat at table." She flamed with anger and abasement, and the sickening need of having to conciliate where she longed to humble. "I don't know what you mean, but you must see, Gus, that I can't stay here talking to you at this hour. Gad, you go to men's houses fast enough in broad daylight, strikes me, you're not always so deuced careful of appearances." The brutality of the thrust gave her the sense of dizziness that follows on a physical blow. Rosedale had spoken then, this was the way men talked of her, she felt suddenly weak and defenseless. There was a throb of self-pity in her throat. But all the while another self was sharpening her to vigilance, whispering the terrified warning that every word and gesture must be measured. "If you have brought me here to say insulting things," she began. Trina laughed. "Dee, don't talk stage rot. I don't want to insult you. But a man's got his feelings and you've played with mine too long. I didn't begin this business, kept out of the way, and left the track clear for the other chaps, till you rummaged me out and set to work to make an ass of me, and an easy job you had of it too. That's the trouble, it was too easy for you, you got reckless, thought you could turn me inside out, and chuck me in the gutter like an empty purse. But, by gad, that ain't playing fair. That's dodging the rules of the game. Of course I know now, what you wanted, it wasn't my beautiful eyes you were after, but I tell you what, Miss Lily, you've got to pay up for making me think so." He rose, squaring his shoulders aggressively, and stepped toward her with a reddening brow. But she held her footing, though every nerve tore at her to retreat as he advanced. "Pay up?" she faltered. "Do you mean that I owe you money?" He laughed again. Oh, I'm not asking for payment in kind. But there's such a thing as fair play and interest on one's money, and hang me, if I've had as much as a look from you, your money? What have I to do with your money? You advised me how to invest mine. You must have seen I knew nothing of business. You told me it was all right, it is, Lily. You're welcome to all of it, and 10 times more. I'm only asking for a word of thanks from you." He was closer still, with a hand that grew formidable, and the frightened self in her was dragging the other down. "I have thanked you. I've shown I was grateful. What more have you done than any friend might do, or anyone except from a friend?" Trina caught her up with a sneer. I don't doubt you've accepted as much before, and chucked the other chaps as you'd like to chuck me. I don't care how you settled your score with them, if you fooled them I'm that much to the good. Don't stare at me like that, I know I'm not talking the way a man is supposed to talk to a girl, but, hang it, if you don't like it, you can stop me quick enough, you know I'm mad about you, damn the money, there's plenty more of it, if that bothers you. I was a brute, Lily. Just look at me, over and over her the sea of humiliation broke wave crashing on wave so close, that the moral shame was one with the physical dread. It seemed to her that self-esteem would have made her invulnerable, that it was her own dishonor which put a fearful solitude about her. His touch was a shock to her drowning consciousness. She drew back from him with a desperate assumption of scorn. "I've told you I don't understand, but if I owe you money you shall be paid." Trina's face darkened to rage. Her recoil of abhorrence had called out the primitive man. "I'll borrow from Selden or Rosedale, and take your chances of fooling them as you fooled me. unless you've settled your other scores already, and I'm the only one left out in the cold. She stood silent, frozen to her place. The words were worse than the touch. Her heart was beating all over her body and her throat, her limbs, her helpless, useless hands. Her eyes traveled despairingly about the room they lit on the bell, and she remembered that help was in call. Yes, but scandal with it, a hideous mustering of tongues. No, she must fight her way out alone. It was enough that the servants knew her to be in the house with Trina. There must be nothing to excite conjecture in her way of leaving it. She raised her head, and achieved a last clear look at him. I am here alone with you, she said. What more have you to say? To her surprise, Trina answered the look with a speechless stare. With his last gust of words, the flame had died out, leaving him chill and humbled. It was as though a cold air had dispersed the fumes of his libations, and the situation loomed before him black and naked as the ruins of a fire. Old habits, old restraints, the hand of inherited order, plucked back the bewildered mind which passion had jolted from its ruts. Trina's eye at the haggard look of the sleepwalker waked on a deathly ledge. Go home. Go away from here, he stammered, and turning his back on her, walked toward the hearth. The sharp release from her fears restored Lily to immediate lucidity. The collapse of Trina's will left her in control, and she heard herself, in a voice that was her own yet outside herself, bidding him ring for the servant, bidding him give the order for a hansom, directing him to put her in it when it came. Whence the strength came to her she knew not. But an insistent voice warned her that she must leave the house openly, unnerved her, in the hall before the hovering caretaker, to exchange light words with Trina, and charge him with the usual messages for Judy, while all the while she shook with inward loathing. On the doorstep, with the street before her, she felt a mad throb of liberation, intoxicating as the prisoner's first draft of free air. But the clearness of brain continued, and she noted the mute aspect of Fifth Avenue, guessed at the lateness of the hour, and even observed a man's figure. Was there something half familiar in its outline? Which, as she entered the hansom, turned from the opposite corner and vanished in the obscurity of the side street. But with the turn of the wheels, reaction came, and shuddering darkness closed on her. I can't think, she moaned, and leaned her head against the rattling side of the cab. She seemed a stranger to herself, or rather there were two selves in her, the oneness he had always known, and a new abhorrent being to which it found itself chained. As he had once picked up, in the house where she was staying, a translation of the Eumenides, and her imagination had been seized by the high terror of the scene where Orestes, in the cave of the oracle, finds his implacable huntresses asleep, and snatches an hour's repose. Yes, the Furies might sometimes sleep, but they were there, always there in the dark corners, and now they were awake, and the iron clang of their wings was in her brain. She opened her eyes and saw the streets passing, the familiar alien streets. All she looked on was the same and yet changed. There was a great gulf fixed between today and yesterday. Everything in the past seemed simple, natural, full of daylight, and she was alone in a place of darkness and pollution. Alone. It was the loneliness that frightened her. Her eyes fell on an illuminated clock at a street corner, and she saw that the hands marked the half hour after 11. Only half past 11, there were hours and hours left of the night. And she must spend them alone, shuddering sleepless on her bed. Her soft nature recoiled from this ordeal, which had none of the stimulus of conflict, to goad her through it. Oh, the slow cold drip of the minutes on her head. As he had a vision of herself lying on the black walnut bed, and the darkness would frighten her, and if she left the light burning, the dreary details of the room would brand themselves forever on her brain. As he had always hated a room at Mrs. Peniston's, its ugliness, its impersonality, the fact that nothing in it was really hers. To a torn heart uncomforted by human nearness, a room may open almost human arms, and the being to whom no four walls mean more than any others, is, at such hours, expatriate everywhere. Lily had no heart to lean on. Her relation with her aunt was as superficial as that of chance lodgers who pass on the stairs. But even had the two been in closer contact, it was impossible to think of Mrs. Peniston's mind as offering shelter or comprehension to such misery as Lily's. As the pain that can be told is but half a pain, so the pity that questions has little healing in its touch. What Lily craved was the darkness made by enfolding arms, the silence which is not solitude, but compassion holding its breath. She started up and looked forth on the passing streets. Jersey. They were nearing Jersey's corner. If only she could reach there before this laboring anguish burst from her breast to her lips, if only she could feel the hold of Jersey's arms, while she shook in the ague fit of fear that was coming upon her. She pushed up the door in the roof, and called the address to the driver. It was not so late, Jersey might still be waking. And even if she were not, the sound of the bell would penetrate every recess of her tiny apartment, and rouse her to answer her friend's call. Jersey Farish, the morning after the Wellington Rise entertainment, woke from dreams as happy as Lily's. If they were less vivid in hue, more subdued to the half-tints of her personality and her experience, they were for that very reason better suited to her mental vision. Such flashes of joy as Lily moved in would have blinded Miss Farish, who was accustomed, in the way of happiness, to such scant light as shone through the cracks of other people's lives. Now she was the center of a little illumination of her own. A mild but unmistakable beam, compounded of Lawrence Selden's growing kindness to herself and the discovery that he extended his liking to Lily Bart. If these two factors seem incompatible to the student of feminine psychology, it must be remembered that Jersey had always been a parasite in the moral order, living on the crumbs of other tables, and content to look through the window at the banquet spread for her friends. Now that she was enjoying a little private feast of her own, it would have seemed incredibly selfish not to lay a plate for a friend. And there was no one with whom she would rather have shared her enjoyment than Miss Bart. As to the nature of Selden's growing kindness, Jersey would no more have dared to define it than she would have tried to learn a butterfly's colors by knocking the dust from its wings. To seize on the wonder would be to brush off its bloom, and perhaps see it fade and stiffen in her hand. Better the sense of beauty palpitating out of reach, while she held her breath and watched where it would alight. Yet Selden's manner at the Brise had brought the flutter of wings so close that they seemed to be beating in her own heart. As he had never seen him so alert, so responsive, so attentive to what as he had to say. His habitual manner had an absent-minded kindliness which she accepted, and was grateful for, as the liveliest sentiment her presence was likely to inspire, but she was quick to feel in him a change implying that for once she could give pleasure as well as receive it. And it was so delightful that this higher degree of sympathy should be reached through their interest in Lily Bart. Jersey's affection for her friend, a sentiment that had learned to keep itself alive on the scantiest diet, had grown to active adoration since Lily's restless curiosity had drawn her into the circle of Miss Farish's work. Lily's taste of beneficence had wakened in her a momentary appetite for well-doing. Her visit to the girls' club had first brought her in contact with the dramatic contrasts of life. As he had always accepted with philosophic calm the fact that such existences as hers were pedestaled on foundations of obscure humanity. The dreary limbo of dinginess lay all around and beneath that little illuminated circle in which life reached its finest efflorescence, as the mud and sleet of a winter night enclose a hothouse filled with tropical flowers. All this was in the natural order of things, and the orchid basking in its artificially created atmosphere could round the delicate curves of its petals undisturbed by the ice on the panes. But it is one thing to live comfortably with the abstract conception of poverty, another to be brought in contact with its human embodiments. Lily had never conceived of these victims of fate otherwise than in the mass. that the mass was composed of individual lives, innumerable separate centers of sensation, with her own eager yearnings for pleasure, her own fierce revulsions from pain, that some of these bundles of feeling were clothed in shapes, not so unlike her own, with eyes meant to look on gladness, and young lips shaped for love. This discovery gave Lily one of those sudden shocks of pity that sometimes decentralize a life. Lily's nature was incapable of such renewal. She could feel other demands only through her own, and no pain was long vivid which did not press on an answering nerve. But for the moment she was drawn out of herself by the interest of her direct relation with a world so unlike her own. As he had supplemented her first gift by personal assistance to one or two of Miss Farish's most appealing subjects, and the admiration and interest her presence excited among the tired workers at the club ministered in a new form to her insatiable desire to please. Gertie Farish was not a close enough reader of character to disentangle the mixed threads of which Lily's philanthropy was woven. She supposed her beautiful friend to be actuated by the same motive as herself, that sharpening of the moral vision which makes all human suffering so near and insistent that the other aspects of life fade into remoteness. Gertie lived by such simple formulas that she did not hesitate to class her friend's state with the emotional age of art to which her dealings with the poor had accustomed her, and she rejoiced in the thought that as he had been the humble instrument of this renewal, now as he had an answer to all criticisms of Lily's conduct. As he had said, she knew the real Lily, and the discovery that Selden shared her knowledge raised her placid acceptance of life to a dazzled sense of its possibilities. A Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.